Welcome back again to BadQuaker.com. Today with me is Jeffrey Tucker from the Ludwig von Mises Institute and author. Jeffrey, we're very informal. Let's just take right off. How long have you been with the Ludwig von Mises Institute?
Well, let's see. I think I was in a journalism program in Washington in 1985, and I saw the little sign for the Institute. We had sort of a small Capitol Hill office at the time. And I found out about the Institute just by walking along the street, looking up, seeing the sign. I thought, oh, I can't believe it. You know, it's hard for people to remember this, but, you know, back in those days, this is 10 years before the first web browser, you couldn't find out about anything. You know, you didn't really know what existed and what didn't exist. I was reading Mises for a few years by then. I didn't know there was a Mises Institute. You know, you couldn't just put in, you know, the word Mises on a search engine and turn up anything. The only way to find out about the existence of something like that would be to get up May Lane or, you know, go to the Reader's Guide to Periodical Literature and bump into one of the publications or something like that. The world has changed so dramatically and so wonderfully in the meantime. You know, we're all sharing information now, and it's almost hard to imagine how we got by at all before we were able to easily access information. Of course, everybody takes it for granted now, you know. As with all new technology, it seems like a human right, but it wasn't always there.
That's very true. I bumped into a Rothbard book in a yard sale in the late, oh no, I'm sorry, early, maybe 81 or 82, and that was the first I'd ever heard of him. And then after I'd read that book four or five times, it was like this either volume two or volume three of Conceived in Liberty. And that was the only thing I had of Rothbard. And then I lost it. So I went years, I had no reference, I had no, I was, no idea that there was a Ludwig von Mises in. I didn't even know Rothbard was an economist, I thought he was a historian.
Right.
And back in the 80s and even up into the 90s, there was no way of knowing these things. Each libertarian was kind of, if you didn't know somebody who knew somebody, you were out of the loop.
Yeah, that's right. And that was, had artificially restricted the size of the number of people who were interested in Austrian ideas because, the first thing is you had to find a professor who would mention in passing the existence of these guys. Since they weren't woven into the curriculum. Control on information was very tight for, you know, virtually the whole 20th century until just at the very tail end, and suddenly everything just opened up. So now you don't have to depend on, you know, professors saying inadvertently, letting the word Hayek pass his lips or whatever to find out about it. You can easily discover the thing now, and that really is what accounts for the astonishing growth of Austrian ideas. I mean, they were artificially, the movement, I guess you could say, was artificially small in the past, and now it's gigantic and global and huge. I mean, there's not going to be any going back at this point. I mean, this is what, in many ways, what we always dreamed about. You know, in the old days, Mises, Hayek, for that matter, Menger and Bavovic, you know, they would teach two classrooms of 30 students, and you could track, you know, what all those students and what did with their lives and who they taught, and you could easily trace ideas and where they were, where they started and where they ended and where they went and what was happening to them, which is strange, actually, because, you know, ideas are this kind of infinitely replicable thing. You know, an idea can be stated one time, and then 24 hours later, be replicated, you know, 7 billion times. It's kind of remarkable, and the Austrians were sort of restricted their ability to use this extraordinary power in the past, so long as communication technology was, I guess we would say, primitive or. You know, it was like the only way people had to communicate for forever. And now we have this tool that allows the stuff to get out. And you know, it's not just about sharing the information. There's an additional aspect to this that people forget, which is that true ideas tend to attract people.
Right.
There's a magnetic quality that is penetrating and bringing about, you know, a change in so many people's worldview. And that's the real power here. And that's a power that's you know, ultimately more powerful than all the armies in the world, you know, and all the governments and all the guns.
Absolutely.
The power of an idea. That's the thing that makes the world shift.
Yeah.
You know, and change.
Yeah. Yeah. And plus now that we kind of are all touching bases with each other, you know, there's a scripture that says iron sharpens iron. And that's kind of what we're all doing. We're refining this thing down where, you know, if you read some of the stuff from the 1800s, there was a lot of wrong. We were going in the wrong direction in a lot of ways. And even Mises, you know, was sharpened by Rothbard, and Rothbard was sharpened by Hans Hermann Hoppe. And we just refine this thing down to where we're getting to the point of where we've almost got it.
Yeah, and there also is a constant sort of learning going on, not just in a theoretical sense, but in a strategic sense and a rhetorical sense. Everything's improving. I mean, people are all improving their presentations, improving their outlook, and that also comes with the capacity to share information. But, you know, during the great transformation of the American economy occurred between the end of the Civil War and basically the beginning of World War One.
Right.
And you have to look at, like, I mean, this is a period where you saw dramatically rising wealth and, crucially, a vast increase in population. So, and, you know, on a per capita basis, everybody was just getting gigantically rich. I mean, Americans in that period were getting richer at a pace far faster than we've seen since, and we're dwarfing all wealth known by anybody in the whole history of the world. I mean, it was an amazing period. But you have to consider what are the conditions that led to this. One was sound money, you know, so you had sort of gently falling prices, so your money was getting more valuable and it could be depended upon.
Right.
You had peace, which is very important for any kind of progress. And then the other critical factor here that is hardly ever mentioned is that you had a dramatic migration from the countryside to the city. So why would that matter? Well, in the countryside, you're isolated, and you have fewer opportunities for learning. In the city, you can learn and watch other entrepreneurs work. You can emulate their behavior. You can meet with other people that have different points of view and learn from them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's that crucial element of communication contact, human contact, that allows for the sharing and learning, emulation, and then competition is the spark, gave rise to modernity as we know it. So if you think about that, I mean, you just try to imagine that what the internet means.
Right.
For the same forces of history. I mean, now we have the capacity not just to communicate, you know, instantly with anybody anywhere in the world, but, I mean, more recently we have the ability to converse in different languages.
Yeah, that's amazing.
We're actually breaking through that barrier too.
That's amazing that we've broken through the wall of Babel. We've broken through it.
Yeah. I was carrying out a conversation the other day with somebody in Galician, which is just, you know, like the weirdest thing I can imagine. It's a sort of variant of a Portuguese dialect, you know, that took hold in Spain at some point. You know, a tiny number of people speak this language, and so I'm carrying out a conversation with somebody who speaks Galician, you know, back and forth using Google Translate. I mean, it's just something beyond belief. I mean, it was rudimentary, but nonetheless, we're able to talk, you know, and that capacity, that ability to talk, that ability to share information is what makes for progress. And, you know, it underscores something that I don't think people always understand about the capitalist economic system. People think of capitalism as like, okay, you know, big owners of big capital equipment, okay, fine. And dog-eat-dog competition, yeah, fine. Competition is a fine thing. It inspires and incentivizes. But the really important aspect of capitalism that hardly anybody really takes notice of is its cooperative element.
Right.
And that cooperation consists back and forth and learning from each other, since no one person has the capacity to do anything essentially other than maybe making net to catch a fish, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond that, no one person can do anything. So you have to cooperate with others in order to build a world as we know it.
Mm-hmm.
And so the more opportunities we have to learn and communicate and emulate and share our productive endeavors with other people that have other talents that we don't have or don't have time to pursue, that is really the engine, the driving force behind social progress. So, I mean, if you think about it, the opening of the internet should have led to a level of economic growth truly unparalleled in the history of the world. I mean, making the Gilded Age look like nothing,
right,
by comparison.
Right.
And so you have to ask yourself, well, why is it that essentially, you know, we've been going down and down and down in terms of our income levels, in terms of economic opportunities, unemployment among the young is huge and rising, so much economic dislocation throughout the system, everybody's getting poor. I mean, the short answer to that is that the great beneficence of that the internet gave the world has been sort of gobbled up and consumed by the lie of the Leviathan state, which has been growing at an astonishing rate. So, I mean, the state has essentially eaten all the productivity we would have otherwise experienced. And if it hadn't been for the internet, we would be right now in a Great Depression like we've never seen.
If you imagine,
it would have killed our prosperity by now.
If you imagine us involved, if you imagine the world in the war state that it's involved in right now, if it were in that condition in, say, 1979, it would have crushed the world's economy. The internet's the only thing, really, that's keeping us alive right now, economically speaking.
Yeah, I'd say that's exactly right. And we should be experiencing far more benefit from it,
mm-hmm,
than we are. We are experiencing benefit in the sense that you mentioned, the absence of a terrible depression. You know, we owe entirely to the division of labor and productivity and communication that's been enabled by digital media. I mean, you're right. It's our salvation right now, and it's the only reason we're able to sort of continue on. I shudder to think what would happen in its absence.
Let's throw in a commercial for your wonderful books. I bought. Oh no, I didn't buy that. I almost lied. I'm sorry. A mutual acquaintance of ours got your autograph on Bourbon for Breakfast and sent it to me as a gift, and I cherish that book. I love it. I put it in our motorhome, and whenever we go somewhere and there's those moments where you just sit down and relax and you're not doing anything, it's the perfect time for that book where you can just sit and take out a chapter. Each chapter is freestanding, so you can zip through the chapter very quickly and grasp the entire thing. And in both of those books, in Bourbon for Breakfast and It's a Jetsons World, the uptick of the articles is so refreshing that you can't help but to feel good after you sit down and just read a chapter or two. It's they're both wonderful books. I can't recommend them enough.
Well, thank you. You know, it's funny. A number of people tell me that. I have a hard time even imagining it because, you know, I don't set out to write things that are, you know, optimistic or, designed to make people feel hopeful or happy or whatever. I mean, I really don't. I feel like I kind of have a little bit of a cynicism about me. I don't think of myself that way, but. But it somehow turns out that way in any case. In other words, I'm not seeking to write anything inspiring.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just the results. As a matter of fact, the kind of books that annoy me more than anything else in the world are sort of self-consciously inspiring books. I can't stand them. You know? So it always sort of rattles me when people tell me that, oh, you know, I love reading your stuff because it gives me a bright outlook on life, you know. Which, it's sort of funny. So I don't intend to do that. I'm glad that that's results, and people also say that the books are filled with humor, which is also amuses me, because once again I don't set out to be funny, you know. But I do enjoy wordplay, and I also enjoy looking at the world and finding magical things.
Yeah.
In the world. That's I love that more than anything else. I mean, to me, it's a boring thing just to look at, you know, history as a series of data points. You know, you have to look at history as a kind of a gigantic mural that's constantly being painted by human beings and human volition. And I'm always mystified and amazed by the next thing that appears on the canvas.
Yeah.
And I like to describe it. And that's pretty much what my writing consists of, I would say.
Well, it certainly is enjoyable for me and other everyone that I've spoke with who's read your books has pretty much the same take on it. They're just wonderfully inspiring. And you now you also are involved in religious music.
Yeah, that's right. Well, you know, I would probably be straining if I tried to make a connection between what I do in the world of sacred music and the world of economics. Sometimes I think I understand the relationship. There must be a relationship there.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing I would say about that is that, you know, this aspect of beauty that I see in the commercial marketplace that I like to write about, I also experience in the framework of a kind of well-ordered liturgical environment where art becomes integral to scripted action.
Mm-hmm.
And with the goal of transcending the limits of time. I mean, to me, that is just probably the greatest thing I can ever imagine. So it's not just music. In other words, music by itself is pretty cool, and I've always loved music. But to make that part of a kind of a human activity that involves something much more grand, this grand project, an implausible, even impossible project of transcending time, and finding a way to place your finger, you know, into the realm of eternity is quite spectacular. And of course, I mean, nothing offends me more than this project being undertaken using music that is not really worthy of it. You know, every kind of music should exist within its own framework. I mean, if I went to a rock concert and they played Schubert songs, I would be a little bit alarmed by that.
Yeah.
Appointed. Well, maybe I wouldn't, but let's just say that most people would. But so it is, you know, in the environment of liturgy, you know, you want music that somehow, you know, is evocative of what we imagine to be the music of the spheres, something that transcends mere physical reality. And that's pretty fantastic. And for me, you know, chant, which is organic to the liturgical framework for very specific reasons, represents the highest ideal of that. You know, there's another element to this, too, with regard to polyphonic music of the Renaissance. You know, the Renaissance, I'm talking about the music written in the 16th, 17th century, was the time of when the world was opening up for the first time to the possibility of mass access to wealth.
Right.
So we really went from kind of scraping by, you know, with bare subsistence, living off gruel, to suddenly seeing that there was a possibility of all classes in society to have access to beautiful, wonderful things.
Mm-hmm.
So the world began to change fundamentally in that time. And I think when you listen to the music of Palestrina, even Josquin, or Thomas Tallis, or any of the composers like Orlando de Losto, I mean, literally there were thousands of these guys, you know, it's not just that they're trying to give you a sense of what angels sound like when they're singing. Nobody really knows what angels sound like when they're singing. But they were also looking around the world and seeing this beautiful stuff emerge, you know, gigantic markets that were they were giving provisions for all people living longer, more healthy lives, there's beauty in that. So, in an interesting way, polyphonic music of the Renaissance is as worldly as it is heavenly,
mm-hmm.
because they were trying to paint with music some aspects of this beauty they saw around them, which they saw as foreshadowing an eternal life with God, mm-hmm. you know. And so you get sort of the best of both things in that music, and this is why I think that this music is also appealing to people who have no interest in religion at all. But they see it as gorgeous. So the same way you can go to the National Gallery of Art, not believe in the Virgin Birth, but still enjoy a painting that the Virgin Mary had done in the 14th century.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there's a double meaning to all of this music, and that entices me and inspires me in a special way. And of course, music is funny. It's like it's always a matter of taste, right? But you know, I had been in music education all my life and never been exposed to music of the Renaissance until, you know, I was in my 20s, and it was a revelation to me, and it just bit me, you know, like a bug, and hasn't gone away.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm very involved in that area also, yeah.
I'm sure you can see the connection in the technological and information leap that took place in that same time frame and compared to what we're seeing today.
Yeah, it is, and you know, the only difference, and gosh, who can really say for sure, but I sure get the sense that these days we are less conscious of the meaning of all this technology for our lives. I mean, everything comes out, and you're excited for it for about 2 days, and then you just kind of move on with your life, and nobody thinks anything about it, you know.
Yeah.
I try to deliberately make my excitement about new technology last longer than it does for the average person, just because it's always good for us to remember that none of this stuff is given. All of this stuff is man-made.
Mm-hmm.
It's a blessing that we've been handed to us, and I just think it's a profound error to take it for granted. You know, we have to remember what gave rise to the iPhone 4 or
right.
to the fact that I can call anybody on video Skype, you know, wherever I am, and the fact that that the business can do their books now in, you know, a fraction of the time it took them in the past. And I mean, what gave rise to all this stuff was private property, market forces, entrepreneurship, and peaceful social cooperation. That's what leads to these things, and this is why I'm so involved in the work of the Mises Institute, because we've got to protect these things. We've got to constantly create protective zones for private enterprise in the world, or else we're going to miss all these blessings. And unfortunately, private enterprise has a great enemy in the state, which
yes.
is constantly taxing it, regulating it, bullying entrepreneurs, pushing people around, stealing wealth. You can destroy civilization with this thing called the state.
Yes.
In no time flat.
Absolutely.
We need to be aware of that. I mean, the state is not friend of civilization. The friend of civilization are human beings acting out of their own volition with their own property, according to their own lives, making their own choices, and cooperating one with another to build the beautiful world we see around us.
Yeah, literally the Jetsons world that we walk around in and don't even recognize it.
Yeah, it's really true, and it's one of the things I love about the Jetsons is that they were talking about the old television show made in the early 1960s, is that they're surrounded by all these amazing gizmos everywhere, and yet the essential bourgeois framework of society is absolutely intact.
Uh-huh.
You know, no change. You know, there hasn't been like a lot of sort of dystopian novels. You see that everybody's wearing the same clothes and people are speaking robotically all the time, uh-huh. or they're taking some drug that makes their minds numb.
Yeah.
None of that is true in the Jetsons. You know, everybody's just kind of, normal. We've got a bourgeois life here, like, you know, you've got bosses, you've got builders, you've got market competition at work, you've got a normal family, you know, with all of its ups and downs. And the only difference in the Jetsons world and the real world of the early 1960s is they had more cool stuff. You know?
Yeah, the gadgetry.
And I think that that's essentially what we're living through now. People have great fears that this technology is going to somehow change our human nature and wreck us as individuals. I don't believe any of that. I think we should all welcome every new thing that comes along. You know, as long as it's comes along in an efficient way and not at the expense of somebody else. I think technology is designed to make humanity work better, and that's a beautiful thing.
Well, Jeffrey, I really appreciate you coming on the show with us today. And Jeffrey Tucker, new book, It's a Jetsons World, and the book right prior to that was Bourbon for Breakfast. You can find Jeffrey Tucker is a regular contributor at lourockwell.com, and as I mentioned before, he's the editorial vice president of the Ludwig von Mises Institute. You can find them at Mises.org, and Mises.org is possibly the greatest treasure on the internet. And I'm not just saying that because Jeffrey's on the show. It's just a fact. There's nothing you're going to find on the internet that can compare with Mises.org. Jeffrey, thank you very much for coming on with us.
Hey, thanks for giving me all the time that you did and letting me ramble on like that. It was a lot of fun.
I'd give you twice as much time anytime you want. Thank you very much, Jeffrey.
Bye-bye.